Blog Talk Radio.
Everyone, this is Monica Liel welcoming you to the LL Research radio program In the Now with Carla L. Ruckert and Jim McCarty. Today is Friday, July 3rd, 2012. Carla L. Ruckert is an author, mystic, seeker, and primary channel for LL Research. Jim McCarty is Carla Ruckert's husband, the scribe for the Raw Contact, and the president of LL Research. Please visit the website llresearch.org, home to over 1,500 channeling transcripts, 11 publications, the Law of One material, interviews, speeches, and more, and the community website featuring forums, blogs, chat rooms, and more, and that's bringforth.org, bring the number 4th.org. I will be asking Carla and Jim questions that come from you. If you'd like to ask a question live on the air, please call 646-595-2294 and press the 1 key when prompted. Again, that number is 646-595-2294. Or join the chat room at blogtalkradio.com/LLResearch. When submitting questions, please remember this is a Law of One Q&A. Try to keep your questions as spiritually oriented as possible. Again, I'm Monica Liel, and I'm talking with Carla L. Ruckert and Jim McCarty of LL Research. Well, Carla and Jim, how are you doing today?
We're doing just fine. How are you, Monica?
Doing great.
Doing good. I've had
one
a busy
big
week.
Question.
What's that?
Do you have the opening riff from the Aaron Crow Dialogues, page 186?
I'm so glad.
Yay.
Your email worked this time.
I'm thrilled. Okay.
Yeah. I should have replied to the email, though, so sorry about that. It's out all day. But, yeah, I did get it, so not a problem. Do you have any quick announcements or anything you wanted to share with us first?
No. We've been in pretty quiet mode with Gary gone on his trip out Wes, where was he going to run?
Well, he ran in the San Francisco Mini Marathon last Sunday, and right now he's on his way back, and he's hiking in the Rocky Mountain National Park in Colorado. He's on a two-and-a-half-week trip hiking and having a great time with a couple of friends.
Sounds like fun.
No, it does.
Yeah. He's a great guy, and we're missing him, and I imagine when he gets back he's going to be so plowed under with all of the things that an admin does, all the email, all the look orders, all the this and that. Oh, my goodness. But at any rate, we'll be so glad to see him, I can't tell you.
All right. Well, give him a hug for me when he gets back.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we're going to start with our opening riff from the Aaron Kuo Dialogues, page 186. Kuo, when this first vision of the self as being natural in its seeming imperfection is fully seated within your mind and heart, then you may begin to unravel the tangled thread of compassionate clarity that has become caught and twisted by the attempts you have made to escape your nature. Yes, each of you is quite pure, innocent, and untouched within the deepest portion of that which is you. Now you may focus on how the relationship you have with the Creator, with your higher self, and with your incarnation can inform and guide you well towards the shining source of that thread of pure compassion that you wish to knit up into the fabric of your lives and relationships. This is a journey from head to heart, from fear to love, from meekness to an acceptance of the eternal untidiness of catalyst, perception, and experience.
Okay, rock it out.
I think that sometimes the Spirit will give you exactly what you want at the precise time that you need it, and that's what happened today. I had promised Monica that I would get the thing to her yesterday. Opening riff to Monica on Thursday so she can see it and read it a couple of times and offer it to you all in the best possible reading. I remembered it about noon today. And without much comment, since there wasn't anything to say, I sent it to Monica, and she did get it, thank heavens. I'm so touched with the magic of the way this works. To a hobo like me, just, you know, limping along on the road of life right now, thinking about whatever I can think about to lift myself up into the good regions of vibration and into that place where you can have a relationship with your higher self, with the Creator, with your incarnational self. You know that it's in there. You can feel it sometimes, that shining source of pure compassion. And sometimes you've been able to give that to your friends or your husband or your wife, your lover or your whatever. You've been able to offer that. That compassionate clarity, as you look with eyes that have no judgment into their eyes, that are able to see that. This is a journey from head to heart. It's only about 12 to 14 inches, but it's the longest journey you'll ever make. It's a journey into fearlessness and faith. They go hand in hand. It's so funny, people will ask you, how do you get enough faith to take that leap? You don't. You take the leap figuring that this is the last thing you'll ever do. And once you have taken the leap into faith, you find that faith is right there, holding you up. It doesn't happen until you have launched yourself into the unknown. I think the thing that keeps us from approaching this beautiful self that is within us is that we feel that we are unworthy. And yet, we have to work with this apparently unworthy self. So, I find that I have spent a large part of this incarnation on the second of three instructions that Ra offered. Know the self, accept the self, become the Creator. To know the self is a matter of observation and absolute honesty, which is not a very frequent combination, but you need to be very honest with yourself here and allow people to show you yourself, allow yourself to vibrate and to show you what you are. And then accept that. So hard to do. It's hard enough to do that I would almost say is a shortcut. It's that thing which enables you to start serious work before you. Too long, you know, before you've worked with a lot in this area. if you can begin to let that vision of yourself become whole within you, I believe that you will begin to be able to see all those pieces of light and shadow that dapple into your heart and are you. And then you will begin that work of learning to accept yourself. I wish you great good luck with that. It's a long road. and I just really, really pray that you may come along on that road in all great spirits and good heartiness. Monica and Jim, do you have any thoughts?
The phrase, the untidiness of cattle, is something that struck me. It's easy to go through our daily round of activities and think that very little of what we came in contact with was of a spiritual nature, when in fact everything we come in contact with is of a spiritual nature. If you look at the deeper meanings that are implicit in how we relate to people, events, and ourselves. Untidiness, I think, is a good way of putting it when you think about miscommunications or misunderstandings, resentments and angers that come up between you and another. It happens all the time between people. And they're difficult and confusing, but if you look at the thread of the relationship and go back to the heart of it all, it usually leads you back to your own heart and to how to open it more fully. And I think that we can take advantage of just about anything that occurs in our daily round of activities and use it as a means to find out more about ourselves and more about this process that we're going through of opening our hearts and of accepting ourselves, accepting the world around us and the people that we come in contact with.
Yeah, and I had a follow-up question, too. Something you said earlier, Carla, you said something about having love and compassion towards your loved ones or the people that you're close to. And that reminded me of something I was just thinking about today, and I was going to ask you anyway. So that's what it is do you think, you know, the requirement for graduation, the 51% of the heart chakra, 51% service to others, do you think that, I don't know if Ra ever said anything about this, but do you think it has to be to anyone, or does it matter if it's just people that you're close to? Because I've noticed, I've just observed with people, you know, obviously it's always easier to have love and compassion towards the people you're close to, and people tend to start with their immediate family, and then, of course, their friends, and then it branches out into their community, their social circle, and then eventually their country, and then, you know, it's easy to not have love and understanding and compassion for people that are different or live in another part of the world or have a different ethnicity or culture. So do you think that requirement has anything to do with the people that they're extending that love to? Like, for example, somebody who might be totally loving and giving to his wife or his daughter or whatever, but not able to feel love for other people. How does that come into play, do you think, in terms of polarizing?
That's a really good question. It is easier to love somebody that's lovable than to love your enemy. I think that, you know, in the Olympics, you get credit not only, say, in diving, you get credit not only for the number of things that you do, you know, flips and somersaults and whatnot, but the level of difficulty. So when you're asked to love somebody that's not lovable, then you're doing the same thing as loving the person that's lovable, except that it's harder because of the level of difficulty of loving somebody that you perceive as a total twit. I think there definitely is a sliding scale there where the effort put into opening the heart to someone becomes measurable. What do you think, Jim?
Oh, yeah, I would totally agree. You know, if you've been with a person, your mate or a companion, a good friend, long enough, just by the sheer force of the regularity of being together, you're forced to be able to relate to them and to find ways of dealing with them and opening your heart to love. But somebody that you don't see as often, well, it's easier to say, well, I'm, you know, why do I have to deal with them? They're just an aberration. There's no reason for me to have to deal with this unfair or ridiculous situation, when in fact they're just another aspect of yourself that has come around to give you another opportunity to do that which is a little more difficult for you, and once done now provides a greater reward.
Yeah, and I guess each person's higher self is programming whatever catalyst they can make best use of in their particular situation, so it all works out. Okay. I'm going to go to our first question, which is from Dream Master. What is zero-point energy?
I do not have a clue as to what zero-point energy is.
Okay.
When I saw the questions for tonight, I thought, well, this is going to be a really good night for asking people to call in, getting Monica to talk, getting Jim to talk, everything, because I do not know. I've heard it tossed around, and what I can do is look it up on Google. I'm doing it right now, and get zero. My typing is terrible.
I've also heard of it, but I don't know anything about it.
Yeah, I think maybe what the person was hoping to find out was if you thought it was something valid or backed up by the law of one or something like that is my guess.
Yeah, I imagine so. About the only place here I found zero-point energy, Wikipedia, so I could just read it off if you guys would like to know. Zero-point energy is the lowest possible energy that a quantum mechanical physical system may have. It is the energy of its ground state. All quantum mechanical physics systems undergo fluctuations, even in their ground state, and have an associated zero-point energy, a consequence of their wave-like nature. The uncertainty principle requires every physical system to have a zero-point energy greater than the minimum of its classical potential well, even at absolute zero. For example, liquid helium does not freeze under atmospheric pressure at any temperature because of its zero-point energy. There we go. I do know that this idea of ground energy, energy that comes through the ground, was being looked at back when Don was working with Andre Puharj. Does that have anything to do with this? We don't even know. You know, it just says ground energy. Well, I'll just tell you what it was that I did for him in 1977 and 8. He was just, his group had fallen apart pretty much in late 77. We'd had a mind link and it had been a great effort. And then after that, a lot of people just left to go back to their regular life. The people that stayed, were pretty much waiting for the world to end. It was that kind of a group. Young people that had believed everything in channeled messages that said the world was going to end in 2011 or 2012 or whatever. So those people lived in Puharj's house. And then Puharj himself was writing. He was working on books. And one of the things he was working on was energy that moved through the ground. He had collected data that indicated that this was indeed so, that there was a ground, that you could work with gravity and create gravity, create from the energy of gravity enough energy for us that we would never, ever, you know, because it's, we wouldn't run out because it is naturally ongoing, the energy of the earth. The gravity is ongoing. It's constant. So that was pretty exciting at the time, and what I was doing for him was editing that. You know, the most brilliant scientists just can't spell, and they don't know what a split infinitive is, and you know, so I was working on at that level with the books, and it was fascinating stuff. I even found a birth certificate, I think it was, for Tesla, Nikola Tesla. Great stuff. So I do know that if that has anything to do with it at all, that is indeed legitimate as far as being being there, that energy is there. But as far as people knowing what it is and doing anything more than just trying to investigate it, I have heard nothing about that. Last I heard, and that was like, in 78, was that there were fishing boats or something like that weren't actually fishing boats. Anyway, they had caught signals that were so exciting that and unusual. It had to be something new, and that's what these zero-point energy things are supposed to be, according to the book. If I understood the book at all well.
And I know there's a lot of people out there like Greg Braden and people like that talk about it a lot. It has something to do with going through the photon belt or something, and I'm not sure too much about that.
Okay, people, anybody out there? Dream Master, speak to us. Well, so much for that.
Okay. Well,
so Monica, I was going to say, Monica, tell me about the pyramids in Bosnia, which I do not know much about.
Oh, I just saw this like last week, and supposedly somebody got an aerial shot, you know, that when you look down from the sky, you can see the shape. I mean, it's covered in grass, so the people down on the ground, to them, it just looks like, you know, a mountain. But from the air, they could tell that they're perfectly shaped pyramids. So supposedly, there's these huge pyramids in Bosnia, and one of them is actually larger than the Great Pyramid. And it's like four times bigger. And there's some controversy as to whether they really are pyramids, and some people claim to have excavated part of it, and there's these tunnels connecting them and all this. But I don't know if it's actually legit or not. I was actually wondering if you knew anything about them, because we know who built the pyramids in Egypt. So, you know, that kind of brings the question, you know, where did these pyramids come from if they are, in fact, actual pyramids?
Right. And that brings up something that is good to talk about in connection with anything to do with UFOs, and that is never, ever, ever believe what you see. Just take it all in and collect it. And when you have enough of a collection of points on your little graph that says, here's this point about this experience, here's that. When you get your research to the point where there's something interesting about UFOs in general or pyramids in general or the balancing pyramids, I tend to think more in terms of the balancing pyramids when I think of the other pyramids besides the Great Pyramid at Giza. But I don't know if this one's small enough to qualify. Weren't the balancing pyramids, wasn't it suggested in the Ra sessions that the other ones were smaller?
Right. There were supposed to be somewhere around 52 of them around the globe. that would help keep the Earth balanced on its axis. I think that during the Atlantean experience, when the Atlantis sank and there was the crystal and nuclear type of war, that there was some problems with the Earth spinning on its axis that these pyramids were able to adjust.
So I think we have to remember that those of Ra were talking about specific things, and besides those specific things, golly, Moses, imagine how many other peoples, I guess I would say, planetary systems, would be well enough equipped to be able to have space travel and to check us out, play with us in some way, or, you know, in 50,000 years or 500,000 years, however long, would something like that happen naturally? You know, you just have to look at stuff like that and not just jump at anything, but just, like, collect the data. And then when you've got enough data collected, you know, well, you know, in this pyramid, the ratio of the, what, the hypotenuse to the whatchamajigger is such and such. And in all of these, it's within 95% of being exactly the same ratio. And so we feel that this is worth mentioning. And you begin to build your data. You begin to build your information like that. Not just thinking and wondering and, you know, positing what might be, but looking at what is. The short time that I investigated physical UFOs, and it was short, it was like 2-3 years, because after a certain amount of time passed, we started the Law of One sessions, and Don no longer wanted to go around to any physical UFO sighting places. He just wanted to investigate what the Ra group had to say. But at any rate, it doesn't take much at all for you to realize that they're here. The data is there. It's blatantly obvious that they are here. Let me give you one example. This back in the day, we're talking about in 1980, I don't know. Anyway, the University of Chicago set up a very primitive early computer to collect data of this kind. And the computer, when it got the ratio of the three landing prongs, could spit out the rest of the description of the UFO, so that they knew if the people were being accurate or not when they reported it, because they already knew what it was. So when you start building information to that point, then you know it's real. It's peculiar. Mighty peculiar. There are elements of it that are extremely peculiar and rather disturbing, but they're here. All kinds of they are here. And I was not as interested in that myself as I was in their philosophy. So I buckled down and have studied their philosophy ever since.
I can understand that, you know, why Don might have been more interested in studying the philosophy and getting the information from this direct transmission from them rather than going and looking at a site where they had been spotted. That kind of makes sense. I mean, here you have this contact.
So anybody have any more?
Well, since we're on the subject of UFOs and you mentioned the Olympics, I got to ask, what do you think about was it a blimp or was it a UFO? What do you think?
Sure it's a blimp. There are blimps all over the place when they have an event like that.
What specifically are you referring to? I might not have seen that yet.
the opening ceremony for the Olympics, there was what appeared to be a UFO right above the crowd, a little off in the distance, and they were saying that it was a UFO because a blimp couldn't have been that close with all the fireworks. There was a no-fly zone, and supposedly Goodyear said they weren't, they didn't, they were one of the sponsors, but they didn't have a blimp up the day of the opening ceremony. And then 4 days later, after all the talk about the UFO, then Goodyear supposedly came out and said, no, it was our blimp. So
yeah,
it is shaped like a blimp, but there's no, you can't see any writing on it. So,
all I can offer is my own experience. The only time I thought I saw a UFO is right down by Bowman Field, which is a small airport here in Louisville, Kentucky. And smaller planes go into it, and I guess this blimp was coming in for a landing, but I didn't know. It was coming right low over this road by the airport, and I was, my mouth was just gaping open. And then I saw it was like something that you can read at the bottom of a screen on TV. It was saying, I am not a UFO. I am the Goodyear blimp. I am not a UFO. I am a Goodyear blimp. Just blinking on and off.
You're not. What? Are you serious? It really said that, or you thought it said that, or
it said
what
that.
Do you mean? It really said that?
Yeah,
oh, that's hilarious.
That.
Oh, that's funny. Make no mistake, not a UFO. Wow, that's funny. Well, they're certainly out there. You mentioned some of the things are disturbing. What did you mean?
There are service to others, things that you get, you know, information from. There are service to self groups who also want to seed information into the population. And when they find people that are interested in what they have to say, and the people are clever to a certain extent, they can cause all kinds of mischief, coming very, very close to their service to others purported balance, you know, and then just one quick jab of service to self thinking, you know, like be very afraid, or we are the warriors of the light and we will fight, you know. You can tell from the way you feel when you read it. If you're reading it and you're feeling expansive and loving, and you know, this reading is really lifting you up, then you know that it's service to others. And if you read one that is lifting you up and then all of a sudden it takes you down, either subtly or quite obviously, I love you, I love you, and then the knife goes in, skewer, then you know that you're reading something else and it's not for you, if you want service to others material. So what happens, and I've said this before, I know, is that a positively oriented entity is channeling, and they start getting specific questions or fear-based questions, and then the energy is being pulled down, it's less and less well-polarized, and the person has an ego, wants to answer that question, and very innocently thinks, well, I'll just put in this little thing that I know, and then I'll go right back to channeling. And then after that, it seems to be okay to put in anything else that the person knows along those lines, and then back to channeling. So those kinds of things are a typical pattern for a group that is very positive at the beginning. And then through some kind of egotism, some kind of twisting of the distortions that the person has, well, there it goes, you know. It's a very, very delicate thing to maintain a service to others positive polarity over the years, because you simply must look like a fool time and time again. And that's fine with me. I don't mind looking like a fool for Christ. That'll do. I'll take that.
Well, I don't think any of us think you look like a fool, Carla.
Well, bless you.
Well, since we're on the subject of UFOs, our next question is about crop circles. And have they been explored in any of the channeling sessions? And what is your personal opinion about crop circles?
Jim, do you?
We didn't ask any questions of Ra about crop circles, and I don't think we've really asked anything to Quo. But I think they fall within the general category of what Ra was talking about when they suggested that the positively oriented UFOs usually give some sort of a mysterious symbol or hint or clue to get the observers to begin questioning not only what was the meaning of this particular experience with the UFO or whatever that was, but what is the larger meaning of life. They attempt to present information that gets people to think in the terms of what is infinity. And I think, and this is my personal opinion, that this concept of infinity and the mystery that comes with the UFO contact is really supposed to get us to ask larger questions and to begin seeking into the mystery of our lives as well. We have a friend of ours who's we've known for years and years. He's on our board of directors. And when he was 8 years old here in Louisville, he and some buddies were out playing in the backyard in the countryside just south of Louisville. And his friends saw what appeared to be a UFO, and they started throwing quads at it. And he couldn't see this with his eyes, but he was given the internal suggestion to go to another place. And so he went to this other place, and there he saw what was a positively oriented extraterrestrial. And this caused him to begin asking questions about the, not only that experience, but the meaning of life in general. And to this day, he is a very avid seeker of, you know, what you might loosely call the truth because of that experience and others he's had since then. So I think that the concepts of mystery and infinity are also within the crop circles because there are so many geometric relationships that people who have studied geometry and mathematics can come up with that would be very, very difficult to plan if you were a human trying to perpetrate a hoax. So I think that they're really meant to get us to start thinking about the meaning of life.
Okay, well, I really liked Richard Hoagland's work regarding the crop circles and the hyperdimensional physics and all that. I thought he's really got a lot of good ideas about that, and of course the Thrive movie, and I'm really fascinated by them myself. But one of the crop circles that I think is very relevant is one that appeared, I forgot when, I think it was this summer, not too long ago, or maybe it was a while back. Anyway, but it was decoded as saying, giving a date, August 4th, which is tomorrow. So needless to say, there's a lot of discussion and people posting on Facebook, it's really August 4th, not December 21st, it's tomorrow. You know, like the world's going to end, we're going to ascend, whatever. And I thought, really? So I looked at the crop circle, and I laughed because it was clearly made by humans. It was not an authentic crop circle. I mean, you could tell, you know, it's real choppy looking. And just this is just a good example of what you were talking about, Carla. You know, people just grab hold of this information and just take off running with it without really, you know, looking at the data and seeing if it resonates. And it seems to be a lot of fear associated with this particular crop circle, August 4th. And it's not even a genuine crop circle, in my opinion. So
some people just want to believe. They want to believe so badly, and then something is going to happen that would be exciting.
Yeah, and there's so many authentic, beautiful crop circles out there that you can tell when you look at them. There's a huge contrast.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, the next question is from Plenum. And Plenum says, this is a rather surprising passage, and then quotes, from the raw material. Quote, session 14, I'm sorry, 74.19. Questioner, how did the users of these sounds, Sanskrit and Hebrew, determine what those sounds were? I am Ra. In the case of the Hebrew, that entity known as Yahweh aided this knowledge through impression upon the material of genetic coding, which became language as you call it. In the case of Sanskrit, the sound vibrations are pure due to the lack of previous what you call alphabet or letter naming. Thus, the sound vibration complexes seem to fall into place as from the logos. This was a more, shall we say, natural or unaided situation or process. Back to plenum. Atlantis is known as a high civilization. I would have thought they would have had literacy, but perhaps it was symbol-based, a la Chinese, rather than alphabet-based. So the question has to do with these so-called pure sounds. Could you elaborate a little bit on that?
Well, as a singer, I can elaborate in general. And I know what is meant by the purity of a note. We in the West, not just to put that phrase loosely, the European, American, we have a tendency to have an 8 tone scale. Whether it's major or minor, there are just 8 ways to go. And so the music is limited to melodies that go in ways that are acceptable to some of those 8 scales. Now, in the East, there are 12-tone scale musics, and there are also just simply tone music, where there are no rules and there is no melody, but there is a rhythm that is driven by the drums and picked up in irregular bursts by the other instruments. Fascinating stuff. At any rate, there are pure sounds within a 12-tone scale that would be impure within an 8-tone scale because it would be in between two notes to our ears. We don't have any way of dealing with more than, we're just used to having 8 tones. And even the old line singing, you know, the incantations, you still have, in each mode, you have a scale which is 8 notes long. So things can sound very out of tune to us or very out of rhythm to us that are perfectly adequate and just fine to a music system and a musical ear that is used to hearing all those 12 tones. It's kind of hard to get until you just lie there. I know when I was taking dance years and years ago, my girlfriend and I decided that we were going to, for our recital, we were going to take this Thai-Siamese fighting piece of music and dance it out, you know, with the two spears and one winning and rejoicing in the winning and going away and so forth. And we did that, but we just had to lie there and listen, and lie and listen again. And about the 10th or 11th time that we got it, we listened to it, we began to get the energies of it and how the music moved and what to do and so forth. And it was really very much fun until, you know, to have that really unusual frame of music to express yourself on. And I understand that my girlfriend is even today going to East Germany every once in a while because there is a type of music there that is without any rhythm at all, and it's all completely ad lib. So she's still working on that. I myself have gone on to lesser things.
Well, I know the Chinese, my husband being a martial, you know, he does Chinese Kung Fu, and when his instructor, when the Grand Master came into town, he was telling me about how the Master was telling him in the various dialects of Chinese that there's like 12 tones of a single word. A single syllable could be pronounced like 12 different ways and mean totally different things.
Yeah, so, heaven help you if you get it wrong.
Yeah. And he was making jokes about how people thought they were making a compliment and saying something like, thank you, and they were actually saying, you know, your shirt is dirty or something, you know, something silly. And they would insult the person. So, well, then how do these tones, that's very interesting about the different scale. I never really thought about that with music.
At any rate, I think that my answer then, now that you know what I think about these tones, you know, not necessarily being the way things are, but the way we form them. I think if we lie and listen and lie and listen, we will begin to pick up the melodies of the universe. I believe that they're always out there and always moving through us. And those of us who have a gift for listening to that kind of thing have repeatedly reinvented the magical tones, because they can hear them in the universal melodies. So I don't think it's really puzzling as to how you get them, because I think you literally pluck them out of thin air, because the air isn't really thin. It's thick. It's thick with the energies of the vibration. And I think as you go through each vibration on your way to the next density, there are accompanying musics and cultures and language and so forth. And it's exhilarating, I think, when you think that just by moving your tuning, moving the tuning of yourself up to where you really are more of a loving and compassionate person, you can find out things that you never could have found out any other way.
Very interesting. Well, we've got about 8 minutes left, and I think maybe just enough time for a couple of quick follow-up questions on that topic. Number one, what do sounds have to do with emotions? Because we know how music really gets you an emotional experience, or at least it does for me. And I know for some people, music is not emotional. And why do you suppose that is? And then the second follow-up question has to do with sacred sounds. And do the sounds have power inherently, or is it because people believe those particular sounds, you know, like Sanskrit and the original Hebrew, you know, sounds that were used?
I think that a lot of the peoples of the planet, I would use specifically the Indian people, have what I would call a very high metaphysical IQ, so that their history is thousands of years old, and they're seeking and desire to know the mysteries of the universe has been in existence for so long that it has attracted to them these sounds that have a resonance to the various chakras or energy centers. And when those energy centers are awakened by certain sounds, there are emotions or vibrations that go with them, so that something akin to the music of the spheres is awakened within the seeker when the heart chakra, say, is opened, or the brow chakra is opened. There's a certain experience that comes to them when they are able to vibrate these words or vowels in a certain way. And again, in white ritual magic, I know that there is value placed on how the magical terms are intoned, so that there is a certain emotion that comes from the proper intonation of the various the words used in the ritual. So I think that within the very heart of the universe, I think in us there is this correspondence of a resonation of vibrations in harmony that brings out these emotions in us, and I believe they're meant to lead us to a union with the Creator, basically.
So do you think the power is in the emotion rather than the sound itself, and the sound just triggers that emotion?
Yes, that's a really good way of putting it. Yeah, the power is definitely in the emotion. Emotions come to us in clusters, you know. If you see something, then maybe you combine it with, you hear something, well, bang, you know that person. You know, you know that voice. Then you squint and you recognize, oh yeah, it's been 10 years. But if you have an aroma, apparently the sense of smell is the absolute greatest carrier of emotion. And I haven't thought of this in 30 years, kind of things come to you through smelling for the first time in that long, you know, a certain way of making pizza or whatever. But I think that it's good to open up to the concept that not only the masters, but we too can intone and use this marvelous gift that was learned by others and shared long ago. There are quite a few different more structured ways of studying that. You know, certainly the Hindus have their breathing and their mat exercises, I guess you'd say. And there are lots of other ways of seeing that energy expressed. But in all of them, what they share in common is that consciousness is a steady state, and that consciousness is, you know, that's the central vibration. And you know, we tune and tune and hope that we're tuned up enough to kneel before our Creator, and then we discover that the Creator thinks that we're just fine. Oh, come on, don't be ridiculous. And somehow that really helps, too.
Well, since, Jim, you mentioned ritual magic, like the banishing ritual, I know you guys did this, and because I think you said Don at the time was kind of exploring ritual magic, and Ra commented on that a number of times. So why do you think that worked? Is it because of the sacred sounds, or is it because of the visualization? Were you creating some sort of an energy field, like a quarantine? When you do the pentagrams, what is it? What's really happening with ritual magic? This might be too big of a topic. We may have to do this next week. But
well, I think the short answer is that we're making a pathway between ourselves and our higher self. The magical personality, as Ra said, is our higher self. And for the moments that we are experiencing or performing the ritual, in this case the banishing ritual of Lesser Pentagram, we are giving ourselves an opportunity to have an experience of our higher self, and also giving our higher self the opportunity of experiencing the third density for that brief period of time. So there's a two-way communication there. And I think the ultimate goal of all of the ritual magic is union with the Creator. And when union with the Creator in whatever degree has been achieved, then a change in consciousness is possible, or the design of the magician is then possible if there is the desire to purify a place or help a working, such as the raw contact, to occur. Then that is possible because there has been some type of a communication set up between your third density self and your higher self. And what we see as magic for the magical personality or the higher self is just the way things are. That's normal. That's just the way it is. In our limited point of view, then we see that as being very unusual, as being magical.
Okay. That was a great answer for a short answer. Excellent. Okay, we are out of time, and thank you so much, Jim and Carla. It's always such a pleasure and an honor to work with you. And I want to let everyone know that we are taking questions for next week's show. At this point in time, we don't have any questions, so please do submit your questions at bringforth.org. That's bring, the number 4, th.org, or you can call in live next week, 646-595-2294. And thanks so much for listening, and check us out next week. That will be August 10th at 8 o'clock p.m. Eastern. And since we were talking about sounds, I'm going to play some different music tonight that has a lot of interesting sounds to check out. Have a great week. still listening, that was Peter Gabriel and Deep Forest, While the Earth Sleeps.